Hi, everyone. My name is Jim Ryan, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Oh, it's glad I am to be here tonight. Clear of eye and steady of hand and clean of breath. One more day. I'm just whelmed over, and I just want to take this opportunity of thanking Ernie and his committee for asking me to come up and be a part of this roundup. This is the first time I've been to the AA roundup in Lancaster, and I'm telling you, I'm glad to be here. First time I ever went to a convention or a roundup, I was nearly 5 years sober, I guess, because I didn't trust myself at places like this. And when I was thinking about roundups and conventions when I first went to it, I thought I was reflecting on the way to the first one, and I thought I knew what an AA member's primary purpose was, to stay sober and to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew an AA group had the primary purpose of carrying its message to the alcoholic that still suffers. But I didn't know what purpose an AA roundup or a convention served until I started going to them. And they carry a special message that of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can't tell you I'm glad to participate in, because that message is, life is now in session, baby, come on board. Hot damn, get it on, right? I've never had it so good. Things go well for me since I've been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am happier right now than I've ever been in my life. I'm healthier right now than I've ever been in my life. And I've got more going for me right now than I've ever had going for me in my whole life. And the reason I can say that is because I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And things go well for me. And I've sat out in audiences and heard speakers say things like that from the podium, and I've always sat back there, and when I was new on the program, I said, yeah, I'd like to feel that way too. I would like to feel that way too. I'm going to tell you how I got there. I can wrap it up in one word. Surrender. Give up, dummy. You just can't make it. You just can't make it on your own. And I have surrendered. I think everybody surrenders when they come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know I had to. And over the years, and over the 90 days, the first year, and every time I made another surrender, the better my life got. And to the point that over the years, I've been able to make some gut-level surrenders, and every time I've made those really at-depth gut-level surrenders, my life has gotten immeasurably better. Let me tell you about one of those surrenders. A little over a year ago, God asked me to slow down. He gave me a heart attack is what he did. And after I was in this hospital and these nurses literally brought me back to life and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous loved me back to life, I was turned over to another hospital and a team of surgeons, and after a series of tests, they decided that I needed open heart surgery. And I had to surrender. Because I didn't like my life being on the line that way. But when those five steely-eyed surgeons surrounded my bed one night, they had x-ray pictures of my heart, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And they told me what they were going to do to me the next day with the skill saw going up my chest and cracking an open like an egg and taking veins out of my leg and putting it. I had to surrender. The reason was I'd never seen one of those five doctors at an AA meeting. And I don't turn my will over to my life over to people unless I've seen them on a regular basis at an AA meeting. I started to line them all up and say, when did you have your last drink or sedating pill, doctor? I was afraid they might tell me. But I'm here to tell you they did a good job. And I feel great tonight. I feel great tonight. I was reflecting this afternoon. And there is, of the speakers that have been invited to this conclave or roundup, there is a little over 111 years of sobriety amongst the six of us. Three of us came in the class of 68, one in the class of 66, and a couple of them came in about the time Lincoln got the measles. But I am telling you, you know, I had to meet people like my friend Sybil and my friend Chuck and Paul Moran and people like that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, just to know that it did work for a long time. Because all of these feelings that I've been telling you about that are going so well for me tonight, and I've got so many friends out in this audience that it just makes my heart swell sometimes when I look over there. Just about every table's got a dear friend in it. But all of these good feelings that I have were not always a part of my life. I do not speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't believe any of us do. I'm simply one member who's been invited to come here and tell you in a general way a little about my life and what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous and what I'm trying to do now. But all of these good feelings were not always a part of my life. You see, I was born the youngest of 8 children to a fine Irish Catholic family in the sovereign state of Texas, and I hit the bottom right there. It's the only state in the whole Union that's mentioned in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. But that didn't get me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was raised in this very competitive family down on the Texas-Mexican border during the Depression. And my parents had very little of the material things to give us. They never owned a home or an automobile or anything like that. But they did instill in all of us a devotion to our God and to our church and to our country and the idea of furthering our formal education. And that they were pretty good, but I didn't like my environment. I didn't like being the youngest of a big Irish family where I was spoiled, rotten by one half of the family and beat the hell out of by the other half. And them big people would change sides during the night. And I never knew where I stood. But I knew everything would change when I went to school. That was where life was in session, right? I learned to read and write before I went over to the schoolhouse. And I learned something real quick. I was the only one in that whole school that could even laugh in English. And I didn't know how to laugh in Spanish. And we didn't do much laughing. We did a hell of a lot of fighting. Even the nuns called me El Gringo. Every time they start talking about Texas history, somebody would say, remember the Alamo, and they'd all jump up and beat the hell out of me. And so that was one of the first rejections in my life. And my whole life until the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous seemed to be filled with rejection. Either I rejected you or you rejected me. And it started then, and I just withdrew. I just couldn't compete. Everybody knew how to live, and I didn't. So I withdrew, and then something wonderful happened to me when I was about 10 years old. My father got promoted. He moved up to the big city of Dallas. And everything got real good for a while. And it set up a pattern in my life that held true for many years. Every time I made a major geographical change, everything in my life got real good for a while. We moved into this beautiful school system, nice neighborhood, and everything was going pleasantly around me, and I thought it would never end. And then I ran into my first roadblocks. And the first roadblocks I ran into in my young life were scholarship. My brothers and sisters were the smartest people that ever came down the pike in that part of Texas. They made straight A's without seeming to try. They broke scholastic records, got out of high school when they were 15, out of college when they were 18, and got law degrees when they were 21 and went on to become substantial citizens. And I wasn't like that. I wasn't dumb, but I just couldn't or wouldn't make good grades. But I noticed the attention that my brothers and sisters were getting. And even in an early age, I needed to be noticed. I wanted to be liked, and I wanted to be applauded like they were. So I started doing other things. At the age of 13, I was a tournament champion, contract bridge player. And my life at this time took on a series of peaks and valleys. Every time I would do something outstanding, I would be applauded, and I would stay up there for a while, but I knew if I stayed up there too long, you'd find out a little about me. So I would withdraw, and I got to be a champion swimmer. And then I wouldn't go to the out-of-state meets because of these feelings of intense, deep-seated feelings of nothingness. I knew that if you really knew what I was like, you wouldn't like me to be around you. I was always trying to be a cut above the rest of the people, and I never could feel that I was in that inside feeling. And I didn't know other people had these feelings until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to be a captain of one of the best high school basketball teams in Texas. But I knew inside, if you really knew what I was like, you wouldn't want me to be on that team, much less be captain of it. You wouldn't want me to be around on those tournaments and those teams because of these feelings of inadequacy and nothingness, but I had to put up that front. I used to love to hear those people down in Texas say things like, man, if that Jimmy Ryan ever goes full bore, he's going to be a world beater, ain't he? Hot damn, get it on. I didn't know what they wanted me to do. They nearly potentialed me to death. I said, what do you want me to do? Go full bore, boy. Hot damn, get it on. Yeah. But I knew if I went full bore and still didn't measure up to being the champion that they expected me to be, I'd be exposed as a nothing. And to be exposed as a nothing was something I could not tolerate, and I pushed it down, and I held back. I held back for many years in my life at holding back from you people. I'm going to give that up tomorrow. I got out of high school and floundered. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I accept that I was one of these kids that desperately wanted to please his parents. My parents were the type of people that built this country. And I loved and respected them, and I wanted to do the right thing by them and please them. And I felt I wasn't pleasing them, and I probably pleased them in many ways, because I was not making a good grades like their other seven children were doing. I don't know if you know anything about the old country Irish, especially those with a large family, but there's one way you can please them, and that's for one or more of their children to join the religious life as either a priest or a nun. And no one in my family had ever tried that, and so I left Dallas, went up to the University of Notre Dame, and entered the Holy Cross Seminary to study for the Catholic priesthood. God, I love that place. I love that big university and the ivy-covered walls of that seminary, the close discipline and the silence and the religiosity, and I knew I could stay there and become a happy man. And those poor priests had never seen anything quite like me. Bunch of Yankees that couldn't understand the way I talked. One priest took me aside and said he'd never seen a seminarian come up there with a crooked paradise, a marked deck of cards, and his own breakdown pool cue. Yeah, I was trying to hustle him out of something, I don't know. But they liked me and they let me stay, and I liked them and I wanted to stay. And I can say in all sincerity tonight right here in Lancaster that if I had been able to stay there and do what those good priests asked me to do in the way they asked me to do it, I could have stayed there and become a happy man. But one morning I woke up and I said, for God's sake, here I am in an angel factory and I'm still not happy. So I split. Oh, did I split. God damn, get it on. World War II just getting good started in the sheltering walls of that Catholic seminary. I ran to the sheltering arms of the United States Marine Corps. Now, they got a program, I'll tell you. I was 6 feet one, weighed 195 pounds, and very patriotic, and I ran down to San Diego and signed up for a 4-year hitch in the Marine Corps. And I dug the Marine Corps. I still dig the Marine Corps. I was going down to the Laguna not too long ago, and I held a salute from 9 miles past that Naval Air Station, just in case one of them was watching, you know. Hard to be humble when you're the very best, you know. The Marine Corps had never seen anything quite like me. When I came out of that seminary and into the Marine Corps, the only four-letter words I knew were Lord and Amen. I learned 3 more the first week. That boot camp discipline was nothing compared to what I was used to in the seminary. I knew how to keep my mouth shut, my eyes and ears open, calling them drill instructors father. You call me father one more time, lad, and they'll be carrying you over to sick bay to have my boot cut out of your ass. Every morning, there he goes, must have called one of them father. But I scored very high on the classification test down there, and they gave me a chance to be what they call a junior drill instructor when I got out of boot camp on what they call the grinder, where they grind up people and turn them into Marines. And overnight, I had a complete personality change. I had no rank, but I had that much authority. And I got meaner than a Skid Row tomcat, man. I used to sleep with one eye open just to keep from cutting my own throat, you know. I had this real fancy rifle inspection, and I learned how to roll that cadence like a tobacco auctioneer. And when I told those lads to knock off that bobbin and weave it into left-hand file, or I'd walk amongst them, either they did or I did, because I thought that's what the Marine Corps wanted, and I wanted to be a good Marine. That'll put you a cut above the rest of them. It's hot damn, get it on. And I guess I was at that point in time a good Marine, because they gave me a chance to go to officer's candidate school in Quantico, Virginia, and I thought I had the world by the tail with a downhill drag. Man, to be a Marine Corps officer during a popular war was the greatest thing that could ever happen to a poor boy from Texas. And I breezed through Quantico because it was the only thing I had to learn to do to get a commission to learn how to drill a platoon, and I was already an expert at that. And I was next to the youngest man that got commissioned that season. I was barely 20 years old when I was made an officer and gentleman by act of Congress. And in all that time, I'd never done any drinking. My mother hated the drink like the devil hates holy water. She wouldn't allow it in the house. You wouldn't have been raised as an athlete in the Bible Belt area of Texas. It wasn't a part of my life. But you got my father used to say, your mother considers there's only two kinds of persons, a drinker and a gentleman. If you're a gentleman, you went to Mass on Sunday and said your prayers and supported your family. But if you're a drinker, you're just like a banana, because you're born green, turned yellow, and died rotten, you know. I don't eat banana splits to this day, I'll tell you. But you got to remember, I had that tailor-made uniform on and them gold bars gleaming, and 400 of us went into this big hotel in Washington, D.C. to celebrate the fact that we'd been made officers and gentlemen by act of Congress. And a buddy of mine from Alabama walked in with me and he hit me in the side, "What you gonna have to drink?" And I said, "I don't know." I didn't know what to order. I didn't want to show him how dumb I was by ordering a Scotch souffle or a bourbon frappe or something. I didn't even know what to order. He said, "I'll bring you something." And he brought me a Singapore sling. It was those hot August nights in Washington, D.C., and it went so smooth, and it tasted so sweet, and it warmed me up, and I could talk. And I could come out of the corner, and I could dance with those little Yankee girls, and I could socialize. And I went back and got another one. He brought me another one, and it went down gooder. It sparkled my eyes, you know. Yeah, you know. Hot damn, get it on. Yeah. I must have drunk a number two washtub of those things that night. And the next day, everybody patted me on the back saying, "Ryan, you're the life of the party." And I said, "Give me a for instance. What happened?" They were talking about all these hilarious things that went on. And man, I was a part of them. And then one guy came up to me and said, "Even though you walked in there stag, you walked out with the prettiest girl that came to the party." And I thought liquor had done it. Because I was the type of guy that couldn't pick up a pretty girl in a woman's prison with a pocket full of pardons, man. I don't know if they're laughing at me or identifying with me. But you know, looking back on that first bout with alcohol, I started drinking the same way everybody I've ever known started drinking. I was in a social situation. The drink was offered. I didn't want to feel apart from the party or the people, so I took the drink. Well, I don't know about the rest of those 400 people that came to that party that night, but I can tell you this for me. For the next 25 years, every time I walked into a saloon, every time I walked into a packaged liquor store, any time I walked into a party that served alcohol, I was the type of drinker that always wanted one more drink. I never had enough. I drank like a pig, and I never had enough. I drank till I couldn't stand up, and I always wanted more. Don't let the bartender shut down the shop, and don't let the bottle run dry. Drag me out from underneath the table where I'd gone to rest the bod for a while. But let's have one more for the ditch. One more for the road, you know. Many years later, I used to hate to see the bars close and everything. Everybody leave, and I'd have to go home. I'd get home, my wife would say, "What do you mean coming home this time of night? It's the only place open, dummy. Hell, they're still serving. I'd still be out there, man. I never wanted to go home." But that was many years later. I came back over to the West Coast and went overseas and joined the hardest drinking regiment in the United States Marine Corps, the 22nd Marines. It was one of these unattached regiments at first, and then we started building up over the years, over the times in overseas. But you got to remember, I say it was the hardest drinking regiment for a number of reasons. The only members I've met of that regiment that have survived have been members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, we ran out of food every once in a while. We never ran out of whiskey. And you got to remember, I was young and naive. And all the officers in my battalion were older than I was, bigger than I was, meaner than I was, and braver than I was. And I was a very frightened young man. But I had to have that image of being a Marine Corps line officer in a combat assault regiment. And that image damn near killed me. The Japanese took a pretty good shot at me, too. But that image damn near killed me. Because the only way that I could cope with that kind of death and destruction... The 22nd Marines had one of the highest, if not the highest, casualty rate of all the rifle regiments in the Marine Corps. We got cut to pieces every time we'd go into these islands. I'd lose most of my men and most of my friends, and we'd come back and regroup, go in another series of islands, and we'd just get cut to pieces again. And it got to the point that the only way I could cope with that kind of life was learn how to drink alcohol. And I learned how to drink alcohol overseas, and I got to like alcohol overseas. And I was a washed-out, drunken old man at the age of 22 years old and didn't even know it, hooked on alcohol. I've got pictures of me taken overseas at the age of 22 that make me look older than I do at the age of 55 today. I was hooked on alcohol and I didn't even know it. But I could not survive without it. I didn't even want to live anymore. But I got blown up on Okinawa. I got to come home. The only way we could come home was multiple Purple Hearts, and I was back in the States in the hospitals when the war ended. I had no thought of continuing on the Marine Corps. I'd been offered a regular commission after the Guam operation, but I couldn't pass the physicals anymore, and I had no thought of continuing my vocation to the priesthood, and so my family insisted that I go back to college and finish like they did. And everything got real good for a while, and it set up a pattern in my life that so many of us have had to go through, that era of honest self-deception, that so long as we're young enough, healthy enough, and things on the outside are going pretty well, what difference does it make if we get a little drunk every once in a while? I got to be a big man on that campus.
I was president of my college fraternity, president of the Fraternity Council, assistant to the Dean of Students. One of my best friends in the Marine Corps' father was one of the senior senators in the United States government. And I got hooked in politics on a state and a national level, and I was going all over the country raising political campaign funds for people that later became president of the United States. But what I was doing is going into these cities and setting up meetings and entertaining and doing a lot of drinking, and I would leave and I wouldn't come back. And I was guilty of a lot of tacky behavior at this point in my life. I puked on some very prominent people in my day, I'll tell you. But I never expected to see them again, and so I just left. And I got hooked in this social situation in Dallas. In my, when we were in grade school and real young, it didn't seem to make much difference. I knew everybody had more money than the Ryan family had. But I didn't realize till we grew up that my closest and best friends came from some of the richest families in the world down there. And we started going to their soirees and their big debutante balls and the Christmas parties. Some of them owned islands in the Gulf and the Caribbean. We'd go down there on vacation. Then we started going on these running drunks. To Acapulco, and to Cuba, and Banff, and Lake Louise, and Colorado Springs, and New York City. And I was always just one of the crowd that they scooped up, put on an airplane, and furnished everything that went with the trip. And it was just a lot of fun, and we did an awful lot of drinking. But I never had any money, and I was always just a good man to have along on the party. I knew the limericks, and the dirty songs, and the jokes, and everything like that, and they liked me. And it got to the point that I got these feelings of deep-seated inadequacy because I didn't have that money, so I split. And I went down to Houston where my brothers were all established lawyers. And there again, I didn't do much drinking because it was a new area for me. There was no, they didn't have bars like we knew them. They had beer joints in those days, and I didn't like to go in there because I didn't like the way Texans drank. Man, if you don't go in those places on a Friday night, lose 2/3 of your paycheck, get your nose bashed in, knuckle bumps all over your head. You haven't had a good time, but no, hot damn, get it on. And I always like to just talk low. I would sit around and talk that trash, drink that mash, spend that cash. Never did smoke any ash. But they didn't. And I always just wanted to discuss things. I never wanted to argue about anything, get in fights. I'd punch people out just to keep them from having a fight, you know. At the IRS, everybody settled down, we'd discuss things and talk. I was an expert on everything from numerology to nookie, but I never argued about nothing, you know. A lot of numerologists in Lancaster. Met a beautiful young lady down there, and we got married, and everything is going fine. Bought our first home, started playing that Vatican roulette real good, and them children started coming along. Not many Catholics out here, is there? And the business venture didn't turn out too well. So a friend of mine is coming out to the West Coast to start a new business. He said, Jim, we're both good salesmen. Come on out there with me and we can make a good living. And his name was Bill Wilson. You got to follow a guy with a name like that, don't you? So I sold my home in Texas and took two babies and a plum pregnant wife across that Cajon Pass, settled in the San Gabriel Valley about a 9-iron shot from Woody and Eddie's, and we started our career out here. And I'm telling you, it was a tube fitting used primarily in process instrumentation, connecting up lines in breweries and places like that, and refineries. And we were hard-working, good salesmen, an excellent product, and started making a little money. We didn't do much drinking because it was a new territory for us. We had these young families to raise. And then one day I took the chief project engineer of the Lockheed Aircraft Corporation out to lunch, and he was instrumental in getting me a lot of business if I could get him to go my way on a new airplane that they were going to build. And he was a nice guy, and he wanted to go to his favorite watering spot called the Smokehouse in Burbank. I walked in there and took one look around, and I said, yeah, hot damn, get it on, yeah. And he said, Jim, before we start talking any business, let's have a specialty of the house. And the specialty of the house that day was a deep dish martini. I could have done the backstroke across the lip of that glass for 5 minutes and never touched the other side. But the important thing was we started drinking those things on into the night, and he ended up giving me an order for $55,000 worth of my tube fittings. And I was on a 10% commission. It was the first time I'd ever made $5,500 in one day in my life, and I thought, this is the answer. This is what they didn't teach me in that tank town college in Texas. You get them drunk, and then you get their money. Damn, get it, huh? And the more money I poured into whiskey and down my customers' throats and drank right along with them, and I had a good capacity for drinking, the more money I made. These long business luncheons and your technical society hoedowns and conventions, man, I swang. My wife didn't like it much when I'd come home flushed to the eyeballs. She'd look at me, and I'd look at her, and she'd look at me, and I'd say, "Springtime, out there in that jungle where I'm fighting for a living for you and the kids, that's the way they play the game, and that's the way I have to play the game. And I enjoyed every damn minute of it, I'll tell you." You know, I've heard people come to Alcoholics Anonymous and say they didn't like certain things about alcohol. They didn't like the way it smelled. They didn't like the way it tasted. It made them dizzy on the head. I'm different. I like everything about it. I like the way it was packaged, the way it was labeled, the way it was served, the way it smelled, the way it tasted, the way it felt going down, coming up. Didn't make any difference to me, man. And I would have bathed in it, as a matter of fact. No, I ain't gonna do it. No. Where was I, drunk?
Yeah.
Oh, I loved it. And then I got so good at that business, there was only one thing I could do, and that was give me my own distributorship. And then I knew I had the world by the tail with the downhill drag. That great American dream, president of your own corporation. That'll put you a cut above the rest of them, won't it? Hot damn, get it on. They gave me the best territory in the world, the 6 counties in and around Chicago, Illinois, and I knew how to train people to sell that fitting and where to sell it. And I went there and hired good people, and that distributorship took off like a rocket. We were the fair-haired people in our industry. My salesmen were winning regional contests, mink coats for their wives, and I'd show them how to cheat a little and win station wagons for themselves. And, you know, and I just sat back as the head guru saying, "Go, baby, go." Because every time they made some, I made some. And for all practical purposes, I quit working. I don't know about y'all, but I did not start my destructive drinking until I had the freedom of being my own boss and the freedom of money coming in. It wasn't all my money, but I was el numero uno. And when the el jefe sat down to write out the checks, I took care of me. And for all practical purposes, I just retired. Decided to become a Goodwill ambassador for my company, bought a beautiful black overcoat with a velvet collar and a black Homburg hat, set out with the idea of assaulting the city of Chicago. It takes more than a hat and a coat, I found out, I'll tell you. I don't know if any of y'all have ever been to Chicago, but if your name is anything like Ryan, and your children's names are Kevin, Patrick, and Colleen, and you studied for the priesthood at Notre Dame, man, every South Side Irish saloon, from 55th Street to 95th Street, from Wentworth Avenue to Western Avenue, is yours if you had the money, and I had the money. It wasn't my money, I was stealing it, though. I can't tell you how much I drank. I don't know how. Sometimes I could drink a lot, and sometimes I couldn't drink very much. But when I was the type of drinker that when I left my home in the morning, I knew I was going to have to do entertain some customers. And that involved alcohol. I knew I was going to have to talk to some of my salesmen, and they were always in saloon. And then, of course, I was going to have to find my friend Colonel Moran, and we'd sit around an Irish saloon and plot a little treason against England. I knew that, but I never wanted to come home drunk, and yet night after night after night, I came home drunk. And the complete inability to stop in a saloon and have a few drinks and a few laughs and go home to my family completely escaped me until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know how powerless over alcohol I was. But I always wanted to do the right thing. And so but I never did. I can't tell you how much I drank. Sometimes, as I say, I could drink a lot. Well, I was sitting around 69th and Racine at Halligan's Saloon one time when old Turkey said, "How much does Summers drink? He's in here all the time." The bartender said, "I don't know, but when he's here on my full shift, he drinks about a quart of whiskey." I don't know what a quart of whiskey a day did for y'all. It did wonders for me, but it wrecked hell out of my marriage. By the time I got home, if I got home, my children were always in bed, the wife was somewhere in the house, and I'd drive in, park where I could, usually right in the middle of the front lawn, stagger in through the garage and eat the leftovers left out in the kitchen and go off to bed before anybody knew I was there. Then they started complaining about all the cat food missing around the house. Hell, I just put more ketchup on it. She wasn't that good a cook anyhow. Doesn't taste that bad. One morning, my wife came into my room from her room. Suddenly an extra bedroom in the house when you drink like I did. Said, Jim, don't you think it's about time you realize you've become an alcoholic? And I thought that pretty little girl had lost her mind. How could you be an alcoholic if you're a president of your own corporation? How could you be an alcoholic if you had one of the finer homes in one of the best western suburbs of Chicago? If my four-year-old son had needed a car, he'd have had one. Anything to cover up those guilts of not coming home except drunk, night after night after night. As a matter of fact, the police had brought me home the night before and given her the keys to my car and said, don't let this man drive till he sobers up. That might have given this dumb woman an idea that I had a problem. It didn't bother me. I got stopped all the time. Everybody I knew got stopped all the time. I used to carry a $20 bill with my driver's license. Every time I'd get stopped, I'd hand the $20 bill and the driver's license to the policeman. He'd look at the $20 bill, put it in his pocket, look at the driver's license, say, sure, and it's Mr. Ryan again. What part of Tipperary are you from tonight? Think you've had a little too much to drink. Could we drive you home? They would never arrest me. For a $20 bill, they'd stop in the bar and have a drink with me if I wanted them to. But they would never arrest me. Don't try that in California, sir. I'll get to that in a minute. They talk real weird out here. But that gave me pause for consideration. Suddenly I noticed my tailor-made clothes weren't fitting too good across the shoulder, and they were binding up. I was getting fat was what I was doing. I was bloated with all that booze. My blood pressure was sky high. And I was nervous. And I was quick. You know, loud sounds like falling snow. And them cats stomping across the high grass just drive me right up the bulkhead. So I found the doctor in the phone booth, and I walked in to see him. He took one look at me and said, do you use alcohol? And I turned around and walked right back out. I wasn't telling anybody about how much I was drinking, especially me. And I've always been a practicing Catholic. And I went to my priest, and I laid out this sad tale of woe about how badly I was being misunderstood. How every time I tried to do something constructive in my life, there was nobody on my side. And I didn't like the way things were going in my life. And this poor priest would sit there and very wisely nod, because he didn't know anything about alcoholism, I guess, as we know it in AA, and he'd just sit there and very wisely and nod. And I'd say, Father, what do I do? And he would say, pray. I'm here to tell you I can click them beads in four different languages. And I can mea culpa, mea maxima culpa myself till I got a busted chest bone and it's not going to do anything about my drinking. If there's anybody in this room that thinks that I'm speaking about a moral issue when I discuss the disease alcoholism, you're wrong. I'm talking about a mental and physical illness. It's pharmacological by nature and medically diagnosable. It's a progressive disease. It gets worse, never better. And in my personal opinion, it's the number one killer disease in America today. But if you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic and you continue to drink, it'll cut you off too short to hang up. I don't know about any of y'all, it just scared the hell out of me. Mercy. I've seen too many people die. I mean sad singing, slow walking, and wearing of the black die from this disease. If I don't get around to it, I'm going to quote my friend Mel over there, don't drink. I sold that business for practically nothing in Chicago and moved back out to the West Coast to try and repair my marriage. Bought a beautiful home in Malibu. The morale of my family went up 3,000%. They were out of that snow and ice. Maybe Dad wouldn't find so many Irish saloons out here. Had no trouble getting a good job. I'm well known in my industry and I'm a good salesman. I got hooked in this syndrome of being a local leader. I was president of my homeowners association, Malibu Chamber of Commerce, on the Malibu Freeway Committee, going up to appear before the State Highway Commission in behalf of the neighbors. Things were going fine. I needed a judgeship down there, and I helped them organize a little election. I tried to stuff the ballots, but they wouldn't do it.
The way Lyndon Johnson helped me, I know.
Things were going fine, and then I started drinking again, and the progressiveness of this disease hit me in ways that I had never known before. I started drinking more than I'd ever drunk before. I started drinking with people that I'd never associated with before, in places that I'd never gone into before. I started lying more and cheating more and stealing more in the areas of finances around my family and business. Damn near wiped out my complete capital by making stupid investments while I was drunk. Started changing jobs. I was president of a bigger outfit than this. left them, went in with some other people, didn't like them, went in with some other people, and in lieu of more money, they gave me a beautiful company car and gasoline credit cards to use in that company car, and unfortunately, some of those gasoline credit cards were good in Holiday Inn motels. See, I couldn't come off that high level of living that I'd had in Chicago. I didn't have that kind of money anymore. I'd wasted it, and I wasn't making that much money anymore. But I couldn't come off that high level of living, and my good credit cards like Diners Club and American Express and Carte Blanche had just been withdrawn because it took me too long to pay them back. And so I started using gasoline credit cards to get $5 in cash and $5 in gas and sign the chips for $10 and never expect to pay and buy a set of tires for $120 before the dealer could even take them off the racket and sell them back to him for $80 cash. Because my wife started making stupid mistakes. She changed banks without telling me. She had checks printed up with only her name on them. And so I started using gasoline credit cards in these Holiday Inn motels. And then I started using my company gasoline credit cards. And it got to the point that that I was just drinking all the time. You know, I see, I'm an outside salesman. I don't have to report into an office every day except by phone. So what I would do, I would work like hell until about 8 or 8:30 in the morning. And then I'd call the office and clear for the rest of the day. They thought I was taking customers to lunch, but I didn't take customers to lunch anymore. It interfered with my drinking. I was the type of drinker that once I started drinking, I never went back to work. And my usual lunch consisted of about 7 or 8, maybe 9 martinis. Just being at the well-thought-of man about town, tipped well, and left. Going back to work. And I had these places stashed out all over my territory. I'd go to one each, one day a week. And then I'd go to a beer joint, and then I'd go wherever. And then I'd come home drunk. And I never wanted to come home drunk once in my life, but I couldn't come home sober for years. And it got to the point that my customers never saw me because I couldn't work. My boss was on my back because I wasn't bringing in any business. My wife wouldn't speak to me. Or she'd say things like, move your feet and where's the money? But that's about all. And it got to the point that the only people that saw me were the bartenders and the people in those saloons and my dark team members and things like that. And it got to that. I said, all right, Jim, everybody's entitled to one drink. Let's get one drink, get your stomach settled. And let's get back on the street and make some money. And I'd go into one of these beautiful dim-lit dungeons, and I'd look in that back bar mirror and wonder what in the hell had ever happened to a nice guy like me. I didn't want to hurt anybody. I wanted everybody to have exactly what they wanted, but I wanted a little peace and contentment too, and the only way I could seem to get it was with a full bowl of gin sitting in front of me. And I'd sit there and say, all right, Jim, get this drink down. We can't even pay our bills at home. One more good break and we'll be back on top. And I'd drain that full bowl of gin. I start to get off that bar stool and I look in that back bar mirror again and I say, wait a minute, Tiger. Tomorrow's another day. We'll get them tomorrow. No drinking tomorrow. We'll work our butts off tomorrow, but we won't drink and we'll get a lick. But today let's have a little reward. And then I would turn and buy everybody sitting at that bar a drink. And I'd stay there far into the night if you'd stay there with me. And I would let you tell me anything you wanted to tell me as long as you'd let me tell you anything I wanted to tell you. And you could be anything or anybody you wanted to be if you'd let me be anything or anybody I wanted to be. And we'd just sit there and spin those dreams. And just spin those dreams. And then I started getting arrested. Oh, I hated to be arrested. Hit a man going 70 miles an hour on the freeway, down there, turned everybody, me over and everybody else, and they arrested me when I got off the off-ramp and took me to the Malibu Sheriff Station. But they didn't know who I knew in Malibu. They got over there and they didn't give a damn who I knew in Malibu. They asked me to take the breathalyzer test, and I was driving a company car, and I had to do that, and I knew it would clear me because I wasn't that drunk, and I blew up their machine. He doesn't look that drunk. Take it again. I blew it up again. And they booked me on a drunk driving charge, but my lawyer, neighbor, and friend got me out immediately. He said, never mind, we know the judge. We'll get this thing smoothed over quickly and quietly. Your wife will never even have to know about it. And the judge is a very good friend of mine down there. And the only thing he could do after looking at that police report was to move it over to his Calabasas court where I wouldn't have to appear in Malibu. And he gave him the minimum fine and no driver's license loss and no jail time. He said, Jim, don't let me ever see you in here for anything like this again. I said, Judge, you'll never see me in here for anything. And I split for the nearest bar. You ever sit around a beer joint talking about 502s? Everybody's got one, just like a Japanese automobile. But as long as you're pouring that pitcher, they'll listen to you tell what a dirty deal they got. You got. Buy another pitcher, Jim. We'll tell you about 2 or 3 of ours. But it was never going to happen to me again. You know why? I went on the wagon forever. The most miserable afternoon I ever spent in my life. Says anybody in here that's ever had a 502-23-102A or whatever they call a drunk driving charge in Southern California, you continue to drive and continue to drink, I'll give you a written guarantee that you will be stopped again. They're after us. They got a whole team of experts that go all over the county, scooping them up. They'll get you even in Lancaster. I'm telling you. Especially in Lancaster. And the penalties can become severe. Because I kept on drinking that same way 4 months to the day later, I was leaving the Wagon Wheel restaurant in Ventura County, and those red lights turned on behind my car again, and I thought my life was over. I knew what the penalties were for a second offense 502, and everything that I'd worked hard for and built up over my whole life was suddenly going right down the drain. My job, my home, my family, and my freedom. And I begged that highway patrolman not to arrest me for drunk driving. Make it parking violation. Make it reckless driving. Make it rape, but don't make it drunk driving, man.
I'd have beaten that real easy that night, I'll tell you. No way.
Hey, Mr. Ryan, I have to, and he took me to the High Sheriff of Ventura County's hotel, and they took the breathalyzer test up there, and I don't remember much about it except this technician leaned out of his cubbyhole and said, "Hey, I think we got somebody beat that fellow in Malibu's record 4 months ago. Put this one on the teletype." They had a pool going to see up and down the coast to see if you get the most alcohol in the drunk driver. I won the exacta. I came in first and second. And the judge came through there and let me out on my own recognizance. He asked me if I had a lawyer, and I told him my lawyer was on vacation. He wasn't on vacation. He's a neighbor and friend of mine. He'd bailed me out and paid my fines. He never had sent me a bill in the four months before because he didn't want my wife to know about it, and I hadn't given him a dime in 4 months. Anytime I got any money together, he went to paying off bar tabs and putting in a stay somewhere. And I told the judge he was on vacation. He said, without your lawyer, you'd be back up here in a week, Mr. Ryan. You're in deep trouble. And I had to call my wife to get my car out of impound, and she came up at her leisure, didn't say a word, but just the way they walked back to their car, you know, without saying a word, I knew she didn't give a darn whether I came back to that house in Malibu or not, but I had no place else to go. I was broke. Creditors were on my back like you wouldn't believe. They were about to garnish my wages, and that would have been tantamount to being fired on the spot. And I went downtown to get this guy off my back and get more time. He said, "Fine, Mr. Ryan, give you all the time you want. Be sure you'll be back here at 3 o'clock with that $300, and there's no way I could do it. I'd burnt out everybody that I knew that I could get any money from, my family and my wife and everything. I didn't know whether we had a dime at home. And I didn't know what to do but accept that I had to face that judge in Ventura County, and I thought of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know you had meetings. I didn't know you had roundups. I didn't know you had clubhouses. I only knew that it was an organization for problem drinkers. I thought you might be able to teach me how to get to drink without getting 502s. But I knew that you were listed in the phone books. Thank God for central offices. That's the only place I knew to go. And I looked up the address in the Los Angeles central office, and I drove up over there and walked in. A young lady sitting behind the desk said, "May I help you?" And I said, "I want to stop drinking." She said, "Are you an alcoholic?" And I said, I don't know. I knew what a town drunk was. I wasn't anything like that. I'd always had a job and a home to go to. But when she said, "Are you an alcoholic?" I said, "I don't know." She gave me a list of 20 questions, and I qualified damn quickly, thank you. I said, "Well, what do I do now?" And she said, "We suggest you go to a meeting. Where do you live?" And I told her where I live. She said, "You're lucky. It's Tuesday. There's a meeting in a small church in Malibu. It's hard to find, but I've been to that meeting, and I'll give you precise directions." I said, "Never mind. It's my own parish church. I go to Mass and Communion there at least 4 times a week. They gave me a meeting directory and wished me well. And I noticed they had daytime meetings, so I thought I'd better learn everything about AA before I went over to that meeting in Malibu. And I went to the nearest one for businessmen. It's called Architects of Adversity. And I got over there before anybody else did. And I asked them if I could come in when I came in. And the Architects of Adversity are different type of meetings they have in West Los Angeles. They sit around a table and talk about the last week only. And they call them fifth step type meetings. You can say anything you want to at those meetings and for as long as you want to, and they'll listen to you. But I didn't hear anything. They started out, I heard them say, "Hi, hi, hi." I heard them, they read something out of a portion of chapter 5. I didn't hear anything. I didn't hear anything as I went around the table. And I was the last one. The young lady leading the meeting turned to me and said, "Would you like to say something?" And I just shook my head. She said, "Are you sure you don't want to say something?" And I just shook my head. And then a man named Chick Parnell leaned across the table and said, "Tell us your name and state your disease. It might be the most important thing you've ever said in your life." And I said, my name is Jim Ryan, and I'm an alcoholic, and I broke down and cried. I could not say my own name for many weeks in Alcoholics Anonymous without crying. I was a shattered man by the time I got to you people. My life was over. But they did pick up on what I did tell them, and they took that meeting directory and outlined 14 meetings a week for me to go to. They said, you go to these daytime meetings because you drank during the daytime. You be at these nighttime meetings. We're not going to come and get you, but you be there, and you be there sober. Then a man named Bill DuBois stepped across the street and made a phone call and got me a lawyer up in Ventura County that kept me from going up to see that judge that week. And I went home that night, that afternoon, late. And remember, my wife had not seen me come home in years, except drunk. And I took that lady aside, and with tears in my eyes, I told her I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what she said? You're not that bad. You know, trying to explain the disease alcoholism to a non-alcoholic like that is like trying to explain motherhood to a stud duck at a poultry show, man. They don't even know what you're talking about. And I went to Malibu that night, and they turned over the whole meeting to me as a brand new friend of Alcoholics Anonymous, sharing their experience and their strength and their hope. And I got at those very first few meetings the only thing I think we can offer a new friend of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is hope. The hope that it can get better provided certain conditions are fulfilled. They said, come on in and join us. We understand. I said, you don't understand. I've been drinking for 25 years. I can't stop drinking like that. Easy does it one day at a time, put the plug in the jug. I said, yeah, but that's for you. My boss is going to fire me. My boss is going to fire me.
Let go and let God.
I said, you don't understand. My wife's going to divorce me.
It's hard by the yard, but by the inch it's a cinch.
And I thought, what kind of cockamamie rain dance have I gotten into? I said, God damn it, I'm facing a jail sentence. And a guy sitting over here, my friend Bob Corwin, stood up and said, you cannot soar with the eagles in the morning if you hoot with the owls at night. And I threw up all over him. Just flashed my hash right all over. You think about that last one. There's a lot of people up and down that Sierra Highway that are hooting with them owls right now. They ain't going to be soaring to no eagles for a long time. We'll get them after Labor Day. World Series, but we'll get them. We'll get them. AA is going to be here. And I started going to meetings. My boss called me in to fire me. He had his two checks face down, the stack of golf credit card shits like that. He called me in to fire me. He said, what the hell's the matter with you? You must be up to your ears in trouble. And I said, Fred, I've had a drinking problem, and I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and he tore up the two checks that you're going to fire me with. He said, you got to pay me back for these, though. I'll go along with you if you pay me back for these. $2,418 worth of golf cart credit card chips for 6 weeks of drinking. And God, he started deducting. Business was terrible. And, oh, gee, he deducted. Oh, God, he deducted. And he finally, I called in one day and said, we're not deducting anymore. And my first thought was he'd over-deducted. I paid him all back, and then I left him. I'm back with that same company today. They came to me a few years ago and said, you're not the same man we nearly had to fire a few years ago. We need you back. What did it take to get you? And they made me an offer that I couldn't refuse, and I've got a great job with the same company, calling on the same people that I couldn't sell anything to, with the same products that I couldn't move, and I do it during, I just have got a great job today. And I started going to these meetings. I started listening to these clubhouse lawyers. Stay with us, Jim. That judge in Ventura County is not going to hurt you. And I started believing them, because every time I went in to see that, I was going to have to go see that judge, the lawyer would call down and say, we got you more time. Forget it for a while. And I was 8 months sober before he finally called down and said, Mr. Ryan, I'm sorry, you're going to have to come up and see this judge. Can't get you any more time. And my sponsor and his sponsor stood me on the steps of the Brentwood meeting. Said, you're doing pretty well, Jim. You haven't had a drink in 8 months. But you're getting a little edgy about what that judge is going to say in Ventura County. And I said, I dig you loud and clear. He said, let me tell you something. If you really believe that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have been telling you the truth, you really believe that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is for you, you're willing to come to these meetings, not drink, and try this way of life, no matter what that judge says in Ventura County, everything's going to be all right. And then he told me how his second offense, 502, had been dismissed on a technicality because he'd been a sober member of AA for 8 months when his time came. My sponsor and my two best AA friends took off from work just to stand in front of that judge in Ventura County in testimony that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous worked for me, and I had a stack of letters from AA members that long, that deep, saying that I'd been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and the penalty did not fit the crime. We got up there, my lawyer met us outside the courtroom and said, "Mr. Ryan, I'm sorry. In your case, I really wanted to help because you've done a marvelous job of correcting your drinking problem that got you in this trouble. And I'm sorry that I cannot do anything for you. I used to just work for this district attorney and he won't even hear of a reduction in charge. And I feel very inadequate as a lawyer because they won't even let me talk to the judge." And I said, "That's all right. That's all right. And this is all I did. This is all I did. I stood outside that courtroom and I said, 'God, I'm with you and you're with me. Let's go in and talk to that judge.' And that dumb son of a bitch sent us both to jail, me and God. He took our driver's licenses, too. It sounds funny now, but it didn't sound funny then, I'll tell you. But everything was all right, because everything that I worried most about when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous either never happened to me, or if it did happen to me, it wasn't that bad. I still had my job, my home, and my family. And going to jail wasn't that bad, because they let me do it on a series of weekends, so it wouldn't interfere with my work. My boss never even knew it. I'd check in on Friday night, and they'd let me out on Sunday night, and the jailer would say, "Keep coming back." I went to 701 meetings the first year I was sober. Some of us have to run faster than others. I was everywhere. I remember the first time I met my friend Mel. I walked into the hole in the ground and he was sitting there and he was just about to be laid off from his job at the brewery. And I thought it was my fault. I quit drinking beer so they had to lay off my friends, you know. You remember that time you nearly got laid off? I got that first year cake in. If Jim Ryan can stay sober for a year, anybody can. I only took cakes at my regular meeting, so I only took 15. I did like manure at a rodeo, man. I was everywhere. And I was just as proud of myself as I could be. And I walked into the 26th and Broadway Clubhouse in Santa Monica, and somebody said, "Hey, there's Jim Ryan. He went to 700 meetings his first year." And a man named Sam came up to me, an old-timer. He said, "Jim, I hear you went to 701 meetings your first year." And I said, "Yes, Sam, I did. I didn't even know how many had gone to until the year was up." He said, "That's great." He said, "That's great." He said, "But let me tell you something. Somewhere, someday, you're going to be standing on a lonely, cold, rainy, windswept corner, and there's not going to be a meeting to go to. What are you going to do? What are you going to do?" And I didn't like the way I felt when he walked away. The willingness that I showed and the activity that I got into in that first year of sobriety, the 701 meetings, the washing of the cups, the emptying of the ashtrays, the mopping down the halls, going everywhere, doing anything I could, I'm glad I was willing to go through that kind of activity, because that kind of activity kept me sober. And then I found out something. There's a lot of difference in AA between activity and action. And the action designed in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous I had pushed aside. They were for other people. I had learned those kind of truths in the seminary and in my father's and mother's knees. I knew all of that, and it didn't apply to me. I was willing to get around two of them later on. And then I was at a meeting at Ohio Street, and a man said something from the podium that went through me like a bullet and changed my life. He said, "Willingness without action is fantasy." And I said, "Yeah." I'd always been willing to be the fond father and the dutiful husband and the dues-paying, tax-paying citizen. But I took the action of staying on those damn bar stools to the point that I couldn't say my own name without crying, I couldn't pay my bills, and I thought my life was over. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for only one reason. I could no longer stand to live one more day the way I was living, and I wanted to do something about it. And I have stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous for only one reason, the results of how I feel today. I have taken the action and I am taking the action designed in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me, they have been the answer to the freedom that I always wanted, to the relief from the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I have not had a drink since the first day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous central office and said for me the magic words, "I do not want to drink anymore."
And it hasn't been that long, but a little over 4 months ago, I celebrated 10 years of sobriety. And if that's all I ever get, I've had reward enough. But my God, everything else that goes along with this program and the 12 steps, the inner peace, the quiet heart, if you will, but above all, the gut-level knowledge that no matter what happens, no matter what happens, so long as I stay sober the Alcoholics Anonymous way, with these 12 steps, everything's going to be all right, baby. Everything's going to be all right. That's the great fact for us. I have seen people go through the tortures of the damned on this program. Death of a loved one, disease, divorce. And they've done it with dignity and they've done it with sobriety. And if they can do it, I can do it. And if I can do it, you can do it, and we can do it. And I got it, what the overwhelming thing that I always wanted, all of my life, freedom. Freedom to be, and freedom to do. Freedom to be my own man. The physical freedom of alcohol, just to be sober, is great. But the emotional freedom from self-pity, despair, and depression, and above all, the spiritual freedom to live. Just to live. I don't think there's anything more spiritual than life itself. The breath of life. I was given the breath of life. And I was given the gift of sobriety. And I don't lightly choose to kick it away either. That is why I come back to these meetings. That is why I remember from where I came. And that is why I pray to God Almighty, as I understand God Almighty, to keep me sober the Alcoholics Anonymous way. But all of this experience that I've had, and I've seen other people go through, I've commiserated with them. A little over a year ago, I had to go through that heart surgery, and I got through that in great shape with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous and God as I understand God. And last June, I had to go down to Texas and bury my favorite brother. And God knows I hated to lose that man, but I got through that. And a few months ago, I had to walk away from a 27-year marriage. And my whole background cries out against doing things like that. But in the depths of that surrender that I've had to go through time and time again, and in the review, there's only one thing that is important in my life today, and that is sobriety. Anything that can come close to interfering with my sobriety, I have to either accept or walk away from. My friend Chuck has said for years, things that finally got through to me, uncover, discover, and discard. All of the old ideas. And when I hear the people talk about the tentacles of the octopus alcoholism, any one of which can wrap around people like me and drag me right back down in that bottomless pit again, and I never want to go back there. But those tentacles take on the names of things like chasing, gambling, inordinate desire for fame and money, a bad job situation, a bad marriage. I was getting to a position that it was getting me down to the point of screw it. It's never going to get any better. It's never going to change. What difference does it make? Friends around me saw it, and I didn't see it until I made that deep surrender again. And I had to walk away. I don't endorse things like that. There was nothing I could do. I did as much as I could do for as long as I could do it. And then I had to walk away. And today, I'm free. I'm free to be. I'm free to come here. And that's why I learned all of these freedoms at Alcoholics Anonymous gatherings. And so if there is anybody here tonight that has anything shaky in their life, I invite you to get involved with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you do, because it has happened to me and to thousands of other people, I can guarantee you that you will know an inner peace. You will come to know God as you can understand God. And you will not drink. That's the great fact. That's the promises that are here. We're all here to help. And we're all here to be helped. And I don't care if this is your first night. You have certainly helped by being here tonight. You've helped my friend Ernie and his whole committee. You've helped people that have come from all over to be at this Lancaster Roundup. So that's why we ask you to come back. And let us show you how we stay sober. I love the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, not for what they tell me, but for what they show me. And they have shown me a way to go that I cannot tell you how great it is. If you're new, come back. And let us show you that life is now in session, baby. Come on board. Thank you for being here tonight.